Okay, recording?
Yeah, recording.
I screwed that one up, didn't I? I was supposed to say recording.
Yeah, recording.
Boy, this is Mom's Basement Podcast, episode 25.
Yep.
Filmed at 12:39 a.m. So the least professional podcast on the internet is about to take it after dark and get even more unprofessional.
You bet.
Like, shirts coming off or something.
Pants coming off.
My pants are staying on.
Scandalous shit.
Scandalous.
I might make love to your pillow, though.
Sexual.
Boy, I want to watch that. Okay.
No, you don't.
So we just finished a 2.5 hour-ish.
Oh, it was more than that, I think.
Yeah.
3 hours?
3 hours.
Yeah.
Give or take, 3 hour session of... Steve Mathers game Ingeniero, and we're going to talk
Marshall
about
Mathers.
That later in the game. That's our second
playtest
segment, I guess, of our Mom's Basement playtest, bringing your game into the basement series.
The basement.
So, before we talk about that, I thought we'd talk about some more general topics. That seems to be the format that we're settling into. About half an hour of general topical RPG bullshit, and about half an hour on whatever game we just playtested. Mm-hmm. So do you guys have any announcements, subjects, anything you want to talk about?
Not particularly.
Definitely nothing by me. I mean... most of my time has been wondering about how to get monies.
I know, my God. If any of you, know how to get money, and you're not a spam bot or an internet scammer, then you're not on the internet.
I mean, clearly we know we gotta work, but that's the thing.
Yeah, I have not been called in to work at my dismal substitute teaching job. In 2 weeks.
Damn. Really? In 2 weeks? They didn't call you in at all this week?
They didn't call me in at all this week. Mm-hmm. And the week before was break, I think. Or has there been another week between there?
It was a week between.
So 2 weeks I wasn't called in, and then a week of break before that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, shit. So this is Mom's Basement After Dark Misery Cast.
Yeah,
no kidding, right?
I'm so broke. This is,
poor.
Yeah. No money in my bank account. Student loan payments. Man, so it's not all, happy, fun times in Mom's Basement.
No, it's not. It's mostly misery.
Yeah, that's why we're in Mom's
Basement. I was going to say, there's a reason why we're in Mom's Basement.
We don't just put on an act here for the podcast, guys. We actually are, as we said, three adult men living with Mommy.
Although we're not all living with the same person's mom.
We're not all living with Rudy's mom.
No.
We aren't hobos.
No, we're not all hobos.
We contribute to our society. Just
well,
I try to. Unlike
I don't.
It on VH1.
Oh, goodness.
Yes.
God. So. Oh,
no,
you know what we
you are not actually a faggot. You just act like one.
Who is this on VH1?
He's just some guy that's trying to get love and he lives in his mom's basement. Literally.
Oh my goodness. Why can't that be us? I would like some love.
He gets a fucking reality show and a couple $100,000 and he still lives in mom's basement.
That reminds me, gotta turn the phone on vibrate.
Oh, yeah.
Good call.
But
okay, sorry for the rant. Next.
You know what we forgot to do? We forgot to introduce ourselves.
Oh, yeah. I'm Rudy.
I'm Mike.
William/Hank sometimes. Me, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Forgot to do it.
Forgot.
Yeah.
Too busy wallowing in our own
misery.
Ah, oh, fuck us. It doesn't even matter which one we are.
Yeah.
I'm the miserable one.
No, I'm the miserable one.
Fuck you! I can be more miserable than you can ever be. And you know this.
That's true.
This is not an asshole contest, okay?
Yeah. Oh.
No, it's a vagina contest.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's true. That's
a valid point. So, and that is actually a very smooth transition to one thing I wanted to talk about, which was vampires.
Yeah, vampires.
Vampires. Do they have vaginas?
Some do.
Yeah.
Yeah, some do.
And depending on what lore you aspire to, the way they lubricate their vaginas changes.
Don't fucking care.
And White Wolf has an extensive... lore about that.
About I'm sure vampiric lubrication. Yes.
But unless it involves lubrication with an actual female, I don't fucking give a shit.
The vampire females are females. Yes. I guess it depends how you define actual, though.
Yeah.
There are actual females who identify as vampires.
Yeah, there are.
And then I'm interested. But White Wolf has nothing to say about how those women lubricate their vaginas.
Mm. That's true. That's true. That's
well,
totally up to them.
Wolf, they do it with blood, so. So I'm interested.
If the actual real woman does it with blood, I am not interested.
There you go.
Yeah, because that's not. Let's not.
Wow, I'm very surprised. We found something we didn't want to talk about.
I backed
about.
Away from that.
Good call, though. I mean,
we are three adult men living with our mothers. We are going to be uncomfortable about menstruation.
That's true.
I'm not.
I mean, almost by definition.
Yeah, so vampires.
Yes, vampires. So there's a conversation going on Starry Games, which is how to make vampires potent. I assume this implies, I guess, that vampires are presently impotent.
Yeah.
But what the discussion is really about, it's basically White Wolf vampires, not interesting, not evocative, not compelling. Mm. Vampires in RPGs, often none of the above. How do you make them that way? Mm. And I think that's the discussion. And this discussion has spawned not a contest, but there's someone putting together a volume of brief story game role-playing games about vampires.
Mm-hmm.
There should be a lot of playable ones in that list.
I hope so.
I don't see why not.
Contemplating putting something together.
It's the genre of the minute, isn't it?
It is the genre. Well, it's the genre of the last 700 minutes or whatever.
Yeah, you know what I mean.
But, yeah, it's definitely... I mean, obviously vampires have become popular, and I think that's part of the discussion with all the Twilight stuff and Vampire Diaries and everything else.
Right.
We are at a moment of... we're drowning in vampires.
Yeah, it's market saturation.
Right, that's good, yeah. Market saturation. We are saturated in vampires. And most of them are not very interesting. And White Wolf, I'm just going to flat out say it here. White Wolf games mostly suck, and Vampire particularly.
Yeah, oh, I made Vampire. A nice transition there with the I don't fucking give a shit.
Yeah, I mean, and you're welcome to argue with us. In fact, get on our comment section and bitch us out.
Yeah, I mean...
Yell and scream and tell us how awesome White Wolf is.
Yeah, I know someone out there's got to be a White Wolf fanboy. Or a girl.
Got to be. So, and I respect that. I would like to hear a really compelling argument made for White Wolf. But my question is, I guess, how would you guys go about making vampires interesting again?
Yeah.
Or compelling? Or emotionally effective?
This is something that I'm going to say, it depends on what audience I'm aiming for. In particular, this time, I'm aiming at the Nosferatu group.
Okay.
No, Nosferatu, I like that.
Yeah, it has to have that dark feeling for me to feel proper.
Right.
But not, like, over dark, like it's fucking serious.
Right, right. Well, there's dark, and then there's dark. Right.
So I want to aim at the people who dress every day and kind of want to nerd out, but not the people who goth out and take it like, it's my fucking life and I'm going to cut myself.
Right.
I understand not all y'all cut, but it's the exaggeration to get the...
yeah. I mean...
to get the metaphor going here, okay? No bitching on that, please.
What I've said time and time again about White Wolf is that if you describe a White Wolf game to someone in 6 sentences, it sounds interesting. Mm. If you describe it in 600 sentences, it sounds stupid. Mm. And the problem is those extra 594 sentences, the entire weight of them is, you know, all the content in those sentences are running against the momentum that would have been in that 6-sentence pitch of the game. Because you get weighted down with a lot of goofy setting content, you start to get ridiculous sounding names, you start to get backstories that are just absurd, and you get these clans and houses, and every one of them is a ridiculous stereotype, and you lose everything that was cool about that 6-sentence blurb about, you know, you are playing as vampires in a gothic world, whatever, whatever, whatever. I'll be honest, even the 6-sentence verb for vampire isn't very compelling. In some ways, compared to, say, the 6-sentence blurb for a game like Demon the Fallen. Hmm. But I don't know, I think, so what you're suggesting, Mike, is a atmospherically dark game, I guess. It's
right.
Specifically about a kind of Nosferatu vampire.
Yeah.
So a deformed vampire.
Correct. Mm.
I think that's definitely an idea. I mean, what are your thoughts on this matter, Rudy?
I don't know. I've been working on a vampire game.
You have been working on a vampire game. Are you going to submit this particular vampire game?
Possibly.
To this
if
contest?
If I can make it work.
You can make it work. Do you want to talk about this vampire game a little bit?
Sure. It's called Blood Libel.
This has been Mom's Basement Podcast.
Grown.
Okay.
We've heard this before, so our groan is expectation, but...
I mean, is this at all related to your game where you play Nazi concentration camp guards liquidating a zombie outbreak?
No, this is a different game.
Yeah.
It centers around the blood libel mythos of the vampire.
Right.
The vampire lore, I guess.
Want to get into that a little bit?
Yeah. Vampires, historically, I guess, have a lot of that connotation, and that people drinking blood, you know, there's the terror of the blood drinking. You know, something comes into your house at night, drinks the blood of you and possibly your children.
Right.
Maybe.
And, of course, this arises out of the symptoms of the Black Death and other plagues, where you'd have a plague... And family members would become pale, and they would seem to wither up and die. It would be like someone was coming to them at night and stealing their lifeblood. Exactly.
Right.
And of course...
Historically, it's been the Jews that were...
They scapegoated, yeah.
Yeah. Right. But not just the Jews, it's been other...
Gypsies, it's been other...
Right.
Basically, you have very insular communities at that point in time, and any outsider group
to the community. Yeah, it's been labeled... with the blood libel.
Right, which ties very closely to the vampire tradition.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I wanted to get back to that, sort of. Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to do it in a really goofy way to also satirize the White Wolf stuff.
Right.
So basically it takes place in an alternate timeline of the real world. And
just checking the time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we're good.
And it's like the year 50,000 or some bullshit.
Right.
And like Nazi Germany has taken over the
so
world.
So they came back.
They came back and they dominated the world and destroyed everything and lives were lost, et cetera. And now all the Jews and the black people and all the Jews, but basically everybody that's non-Aryan.
Right, that would have been labeled as subhuman by the Nazis.
It would have been labeled as subhuman by the Nazis. It had been turned into cute little animals.
So, like, Disney anthropomorphic.
Disney. Kind of. Except, like, see, what I... The way
Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers?
No, the way I describe this game is, like, a combination between Tom and Jerry, anti-Semitism, and, like, Vampire the Masquerade.
So, okay.
So I would say those. My side, I just saw Mike shiver.
That wasn't a shiver, that was an actual seizure, but...
Oh, okay.
The rub of the head was, yeah, in response to that.
Oh, okay. But, yeah, so it's kind of Tom and Jerry meets, like, Downfall, I guess. I don't know.
So it's the kind of thing Walt Disney would have made if he had survived.
That,
you know, and hadn't had to hide the fact that he was a Nazi sympathizer.
That's basically that. And, you know, I'm not an anti-Semite, and I don't want to, you know, go there and make people uncomfortable. Well, I do want to make people uncomfortable, but I don't want
to... I'd say your games mostly exist to make people uncomfortable.
But I don't want to, like, dredge up all the historical stuff besides the key premise, which is Bloodline.
Right.
But, you know, I just thought it was an interesting, ridiculous premise for a game, and I thought that to center it around something like Blood Libel, you really have to have something to kind of disarm so it doesn't become too dark.
Right.
It doesn't become
and
too...
And that's why the cartoonish animals are in there.
And, like, the SS are exterminators, like, literal exterminators in there.
So, yeah, it really is.
It's kind of...
Tom and Jerry.
Yeah, it is. Buchenwald. And in it, you can play as basically any race that's been accused of blood libel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you play as also any animal that's accused. There's the duality of the animals that are accused of blood libel. So, whereas, you know, you don't have rats coming in and drinking blood. Rats have been accused of drinking blood and doing that kind of stuff. You don't have roaches don't drink blood and bats don't drink blood. But a lot of people think they do.
Right.
Urban legends and that kind of stuff.
Right. Oh, so I see now. See, that's something I didn't know about the game before,
which is
that the animals you pick are things that have traditionally or in old wives' tales and folklore been accused of being blood-drinking
because
animals.
I wanted to bring in that urban legends type dealy that White Wolf, I think, actually does well. Does, you know, pretty... I don't know. I think that's one of the things White Wolf does well. But, that's the game, basically. That's the premise of it.
So, how does this make vampires cool?
I guess they're supposed to be vampires. You know, you're drinking blood, you're going around, you're...
Well, I guess, what makes that... How does this take the vampire tradition and make it cool again, is what I'm saying. Or how are you attempting to make it cool again?
Well... I think that by going back to the actual roots of the tradition, the blood libel, and the, you know, the really dangerous shit.
Right.
It made it relevant.
Shit.
That
exactly.
is what made it relevant.
Exactly.
You know, people got killed over that shit.
Right.
So, I mean, I think to go back to that, that's really what I want to try to focus on.
Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that you said... go back to the roots of this shit. Because this is what I do whenever I'm trying to design a game on a certain topic.
Yeah.
I go on Wikipedia and where, and I try to search it back to the point where it no longer sounds stupid to me.
Right.
It's like, okay, stupid, campy, odd, and then you just trace it back until you get to the point where it's like, oh, suddenly this kicks me in the stomach.
Right.
And I have to look at it. And this is what I did with when I was researching Dance Macabre. Mm. I had the idea, okay, I want to do a game that's about, you know, the Memento Mori and images of death. And so I just went through Wikipedia pages. And this is what I did again recently when I saw about this vampire challenge.
Mm.
And, you know, and you end up finding a lot of really cool stuff.
Right.
Not that I need to tell anyone who's listening to this that. It's like, newsflash. If you look at Wikipedia, you can find some cool shit.
Yeah.
But, I mean, one interesting thing, and ultimately I didn't stick with this, but there's more political ramifications to it than even what you were talking about. Because if you look at the point when the vampire coalesces, and it comes together into the thing that we're talking about now, it's in the 19th century. And it's right at the moment when Marxism is rising, when you're developing a middle class and all of this. And what's the image of the vampire that comes together at that point in time? This parasitic nobleman who's literally living off of his... the people on his, his serfs.
Right.
And so that's the mythology there, which is, it was a way for the middle class, and, you know, most of the writers at that time ceased being, they weren't working under the patronage system anymore, where, the aristocracy was keeping them, paying them to write.
Right.
It was the rise of the printing press and the middle class
writer. Yeah.
And if you look, and that's also when you start to get horror, and the penny dreadfuls and all that stuff is the first true middle class tradition of writing. You get the rise of, proto-pulp almost.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And all of that comes together in the vampire as this image of what we're casting aside, the aristocracy or these parasites we need to get rid of. So you get the parasitic vampire aristocrat who's literally draining the blood of his peasants.
See, I like that.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. My only thing, and I'm sorry, Mike, though, for interrupting you, but...
Yeah, you go for it.
I'll get it out of the way and then you can talk. what's the Kanye West thing?
I'm gonna let you finish.
I was thinking about, well, how do you update this? And I decided not to because I think that ways to update this to modern politics would seem very campy, which could be cool.
That could be really cool.
But it wasn't exactly what I wanted to do. You know, you'd have things like a vampire hedge fund manager and shit, And Vampire Enron or Vampire Bank of Blood Bank of America or whatever. But what were you going to say, Mike?
Well, in a way, I was going to say that while the origin of a vampire is very true that it's like 19th century,
right?
You could even go farther back
than
that.
You can go much farther back than that.
Like the 1400s.
Yeah, and you can go even further back than that. You can go pre-Christian period in Romania, and all of these different cultures have this vampire mythology that eventually creates this 19th century pulp vampire.
And the whole basis of that, though, was to keep the community together.
Yes.
No, yeah.
It was like, there's big, bad, scary, unknown shit out there, and it's going to fucking kill you, so you got to keep together.
Right.
Survive together, and that's what it was all about. I think that may be another option idea.
It is another option, and what I ultimately settled on was very close to what you said, so I'm glad you said it, which is, I said, okay, and I went even farther back, and... what you find is the vampire legends arise out of this thing called Revenant. Am I pronouncing that right?
Revenant. Yeah. That's correct.
So Revenant, well, vampire is just a one possible line of the Revenants. And what they were really were, that's just the idea of a corpse. That, someone dies, their corpse is buried, the corpse rises from the grave and starts harassing people. But what's really interesting about them is, okay, the one thing that bothers me about vampires, or they're so impersonal, it's always, the guy never knows the vampire when he shows up at his door and starts drinking his blood. Or it's always some aristocrat who's in a castle somewhere. Right. Or even in Vampire the Masquerade, they have their houses and they have their whole separate society and they're cloistered. But the Revenant was usually, they go back and they harass the people that they knew in life. And often it's someone who has some kind of personal guilt or leftover harsh feelings or whatever. For example, there was this dude, okay, he thinks his wife is cheating on him,
right?
So he gets up in the rafters of their house and he hides in the rafters of their house and waits for her to come home. And sure enough, she comes home with a dude and starts banging him, right?
Yeah.
But, and he gets so startled by this that he falls from the rafters, and dies. Hits his head, boom, he's done. You know, and this is, you know, the 11th century or whatever, so that's it. I mean, not much modern medicine can do for you.
Yeah.
And so they bury him, and then his wife starts waking up in the middle of the night, and she feels someone sitting on her, sitting on her chest.
On her chest, yeah.
And she... And it's him, you know, she sees him. Now, this is, in reality, this is probably night terrors, sleep paralysis.
Right.
But she has a sensation that he's coming back at night, and he's literally sitting right on top of her while she sleeps. And these other Revenant legends are all like that. It's someone, it's the result of, you know, a unfulfilled personal connection between two people, or guilt, or something like that, you know, and it's not necessarily, or it could be someone who was, you know, who was in a village, who was well known by the other villagers, who dies with some kind of unfinished business, and they come back. But what I liked about this was it makes it personal. In fact, there's legends in these societies where you were supposed to keep a window open for something like 40 days. They called it the 40 days of passing. You kept windows or doors or something open so that the dead could pass through your house because supposedly they stayed, their spirits anyway, stayed in the community for 40 days after they were gone. But what I was, like I was saying, what is really interesting to this about this to me is that it makes the whole vampire thing personal again.
Right.
Suddenly the vampire isn't some dude who comes out of his castle and swoops into your house and drains your blood. It's someone you knew, and it's someone you had a personal connection with, and it's someone who you have unfinished business with. So, and it also flips the scenario, the traditional way of looking at vampires, especially in role-playing games, on its head, which is that the focus is the vampires, and they the players play vampires, and they play the vampires, and they interact with humans, and the humans are peripheral, and they're side characters. But really, this is the people, the community, creating the vampire, and I want to, and that gets into all of the
See, that's really interesting.
Mass delusion, paranoia stuff that really is tied to most of the vampire legend, which is someone has some type of experience, and then everyone starts to have this experience. And maybe it's caused by disease, as in the blood libel stuff, or because someone has some kind of sighting, or because something mysterious happens. But the legend grows, and the paranoia grows throughout the community. So I haven't figured out how to have mechanics for this. I need some kind of mass paranoia mechanics. But one thing I did want to do is to have it structured so maybe one player is the vampire and the other players are people in the community. But the GM role is kind of flipped around here, with the players actually adding traits to the vampire, narrating the vampire's behavior. You know, it's almost like an inversion of the usual one GM, you know, and then everyone else is players. It's like everyone's a GM. Most of the players are quasi-GM as members of the community talking about this vampire. And then one player is a vampire. And the trick would be that all of the players would have to have some kind of, you know, unfinished business with the person who died. So they'd have to have, maybe they're guilty about some way they treated him, and that would all be woven into the scene somehow, but I haven't figured out how to do it yet.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
As far as the mass paranoia goes, in real life psychology, it spreads exactly like a disease. So you got something there. Not so much to what to do with the rats.
I don't know. I mean, I was thinking of maybe doing the... doing kind of like Dance Macabre has life scenes and death scenes, doing flashbacks to people's dealing with the vampire individual when they were alive, and then present-day vampire paranoia.
Yeah, that could definitely work.
Something like that, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
One other thing that I wanted to incorporate, I mean, a lot of the vampire legends come out of the fact that the natural stages of decay were not very well understood by people. And because bodies decay at different rates and in different ways, they dig up some dude, you know, they'd find the corpse, and it looked like they had a redder complexion than they had in life, because
blood was draining and however it was, you know, blood, and the gases that built up in bodies would make the corpse look swollen, like they had just fed, all these things, and maybe they had buried them with their eyes closed, but one eye is open when they dig them up, and all of these things.
Yeah.
And the growth, well, the not actual growth, but the illusion of growth of fingernails and hair after death because the skin pulls away. And I wanted to get those gruesome details in there somehow. Mm. I wanted a way so that as the scenes went on, you added more and more of these decay elements to the player who's the vampire.
Mm.
But I don't know, I've been thinking about hat mechanics, card mechanics, and trying to get paranoid, but I don't have anything yet, but...
There's a lot of stuff to work with there.
Yeah, seems pretty...
About how far into
half an hour.
About half an hour.
Ooh, half an hour, yeah.
So any more thoughts on vampires and...
Not really, vampires are really kind of...
Meh.
Yeah.
You don't think that any amount of stuff would make vampires cool?
No, I think you can make them maybe a little cool.
I think you could definitely make them cool, but then you might have the... I think this becomes the case of where the audience ruins it more than the vampire.
Yeah, that's true.
That's and you gotta watch that. That's why I said specifically with the Nosferatu stuff.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Often the case with RPGs.
I think in this case you have to make it something that you yourself really dig.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. And I think... One thing that's been circulating through all of what we've been saying is that you have to find a way to make them relevant and you have to find a way to make them personal. Because the impersonal, because everything about, the more you try to make a vampire cool, I think the more you make it irrelevant and impersonal. And I think that's something to work against.
That's true.
So, Ingenero.
Yes.
This Ingenero is, I think, a really ambitious game.
It is.
Very ambitious. It seems to me that what Stephoid is trying to do is to really make narrativist GURPS, which is to say a highly generalizable, generic narrative building system as opposed to simulation building system, you know.
Right.
And to that end, I think he's on to something, definitely.
Yeah,
I definitely agree there. I liked it for the most part. I can definitely say that right now.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun with what we
did. That we did.
Yeah.
Maybe too much fun, as the case sometimes.
You may hear a lot of complaints out of me, but don't take that the wrong way.
No, I mean, they come to be constructive criticism.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I may say more negative than positive, but overall I had way more positive than negative.
Yeah. I mean, I like the ambition of it a lot. I wish he had been a little bit more clear about framing that ambition within the, at the beginning of the text, saying, this is really what I'm trying to do with this.
Yeah.
So that I didn't have to... decide for myself that it looks like he's trying to make a kind of generic universal narrative building system. I wish he had just said that, because right now the beginning of the game doesn't really have a hook. You know, it doesn't really have something that sells
the game.
Doesn't
have anything that distinguishes it.
So. Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
I think he's also trying to make something that is a way to convince beginners, you know, explain this narrative way of playing role-playing game, or the story games method of playing role-playing game, to people who don't play role-playing games or who usually play D&D style roll the dice.
Yeah, combat-based stuff.
And I think he definitely succeeds there. I don't know, what were your guys' thoughts on this?
I'll let Rudy go first.
I think he, I think it's definitely pretty ambitious. And I like the way he gives examples. That's the one thing. But I think there should be a lot more examples.
Right. And I think there should be some original examples as opposed to having most of them be film examples.
Be film, yeah, exactly. Although that's the way that he wants most people to play it.
Then, if this is supposed to be a game for creating, recreating films that you enjoy, and he does mention
when you're framing the setting, you know, to compare it to a film.
Right.
But if making it like playing a film is a big part of what the goal is, then that needs to
that
be
needs
at the
to
beginning.
Be up front. Yeah,
yeah, that does. Because that changes the tone a decent bit, I would imagine.
Yeah.
As far as the parts of the game, character creation, I'm not sure if we correctly did it.
Yeah.
Because it didn't feel like we were using all of the things we created during character creation, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I know we did the character creation correctly. I just don't know if we played it out right.
If we played it out right. We definitely used the backgrounds.
And, yeah,
But I'm not sure how beliefs and desires and all of that really tie in.
The motivations exactly make no sense to me right now.
Well, one thing is,
it makes sense to help get the character crystallized.
Right. And yeah, that's what it's about, I think. But, I mean, the backgrounds got played a lot because they have real consistent mechanical weight.
Mm.
They dictate what dice you roll, and they also... And this is definitely something that's good about it, is they take something that people who play other role-playing, less narrative-centric, less story-game-centric role-playing games would be familiar with, like classes, and turns it into a narrative thing.
Right, right.
That still has some mechanical weight. And having, you know, X number in background really isn't that fundamentally different than having a certain number of class levels. And I think that's smart. But you're right about the motivations. I think the reality is it's exactly what you're saying, Rudy. They're there to help you crystallize your character. Mm. It's really a brainstorming session, I think, thinking about your character. And if you use it, you use it. If you don't, you don't.
Right.
I think he could have cut it down to three motivations. So
maybe, yeah.
Or simplify the motivations or combine some motivations.
Yeah.
Because
influences were really tough.
Yeah. Yeah, influences.
That was one I wasn't really sure how to.
Influences
it
were...
sort of bled into issues and disposition, even maybe.
Right, it did. It seemed to be right between issues and disposition. And it was difficult to tease out, especially given the introduction and the text, what exactly influences were supposed to be. I don't know if you needed two beliefs, and I really don't know if you need. All of this framed exactly how it is. I'm not sure if it's the best way to arrive at an interesting story section.
It did sort of... One thing that did help the story section a lot, though, was the long-term goals.
Yes.
I really love the way the goals work in this, because...
No question
And
about
you
that.
Could... The way short-term goals, you could set them, and then you could... just kind of forget about it, and it would almost resolve itself.
Right, right.
Kind of because you just...
And one thing about the goals that I really liked was the points for abandonment thing.
Right, exactly.
That
right.
was very smart, because it gets at a reality of how plots are actually structured that I think a lot of games overlook, which is that sometimes it's just as or more fulfilling... to have a character not get what he's chasing after, but not get it in a compelling way that is revolutionary for the character.
Exactly.
And I think that a lot of games, it's like, oh, well, maybe I would like to make it so that my character evolves beyond needing this thing he's been chasing for all this time.
Mm.
But if I don't continue to pursue it, I won't get the mechanical benefit, so I'm going to continue pursuing this.
Yeah, no, that's definitely...
By giving a mechanical benefit for having a personal revelation that changes your outlook, I think that's a good idea.
Hmm.
But, Mike, it seemed like you were going to say something about motivations.
The only thing I really have to add is... to add to the crystallized thing...
Right.
They were there to flesh out the actor, more or less, in this case.
Mm-hmm.
To, you know, that's all I really want to say. To really get yourself into the mood, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like to me.
Yeah, and you get a sense of your character. No, what were you going to say?
No, nothing. Yeah.
My concern is that often that isn't what actually happens in games.
Right.
Which is to say that often you put a lot of stuff on your character sheet, but then the character actually crystallizes in play.
Right.
And the character sheet can become something that you look at and you start to say, ooh, but I'm not doing this.
Yeah, exactly.
And you lose some confidence in your character, which you may be playing fine and may be enjoying playing, but you say, ooh, shoot, you know, I never really got to my abandonment issues, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
And I think there needs to be... I think the motivations need to serve as something that helps you to brainstorm your character without becoming something that you have to keep thinking about and play as your character continues to evolve. What else?
We didn't end up using body and soul.
Very much.
Yeah. No, we didn't use that at all.
I didn't see anything fundamentally wrong with that. It's very simple.
Yeah.
There's purpose to it. It's just we didn't end up using it.
Right. I wish we had ended up using it a little bit more than we did, because I would have liked to see how mechanically balanced that is. Because if your default loss is 3 in any given stat.
Mm-hmm.
Then you, and he recommends that the GM frame scenarios so that if you lose, they're a challenge level where you're likely to lose some body and soul, so that the players have to keep feeding their points back into body and soul.
You have to feed your reward points back.
Right, which I don't know. I don't know if I like that.
I don't know. I think that makes people, that sort of keeps people on task, I guess.
I don't know. I don't know if this is the right analogy, but the way that sounds, it sounds like a certain chip stacking problem we had before.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
I was
that's
thinking
true.
Of that, too. Yeah. I think the issue here is people... If something is framed as a reward, people don't want to use it to hold ground. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Which is to say that, it might in some level, if someone, especially if you have someone who's approaching it from a very gamey perspective, and you're trying to convince them to approach it in a story game way, the natural thing to do would be to avoid taking risks whenever possible, because you want to bank your reward points, because those same points can be used, and this is exactly what Mike is getting at with the chips analogy, the same points can be used to buy cool shit. You can buy points for your plays. So if you have to throw them back into body and soul, you feel like you just lost something
that you
invested in.
Yeah, and also, if you do it that way, it encourages people to make easy short-term goals.
Right.
That's true. That's
yes. Really and just to explain to people listening what this chips analogy is, at one point, there was a game that was designed and played within this group that had currency chips that could be bet in play.
Yeah.
And cashed in at the end of the session to buy mechanical advantage. So you could bet these currency chips in battle or in other scenarios that came up in play and then bank them. Yeah. And you could also spend them on in-play things, and you needed to actually sort of spend them in order to keep moving in the game.
Yeah.
And what we found was players would basically hoard their chips. And they would not want to engage in really challenging things because they might lose their chips.
Yeah.
And it became a real problem.
Yeah.
Risk-reward doesn't tend to work out.
And if this is a game really trying to focus on developing interesting plots, that could become a distraction rather than an advantage.
Yeah.
Because anything that kind of forms a feedback loop with making easy goals.
Maybe not a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't even know if it's necessarily the easy goals as much as it's the risk-reward.
Yeah.
When people do that, they play conservatively.
Yes, exactly. Especially if the system encourages them to do so.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. There's no take-backs, motherfucker.
No.
Yeah.
As far as the structure of the game, I have no complaints. I like the structure of the game.
Yeah.
I like the fact that you have a front-loaded setting creation session. Maybe that's not everyone's cup of tea, but we've used it in our games.
Yeah.
Rudy uses it in several of his games.
And it's always been a blast to do it, and we had fun tonight doing it.
Yeah, we did have fun.
Yeah.
I like the transition between the story mode and the challenge mode.
That was really good.
Idea of even the story mode being more abstract and about,
yeah,
you know, building the narrative, and then you,
yeah,
play the scene.
It helps pace it.
It does help pace it, and it's something that groups tend to naturally do anyway,
yeah,
and it's nice to see it there in the text explained so that people who might not be familiar with that kind of play or in forum, so that no one's entering the game with confused expectations,
mm-hmm,
which is something the game,
yeah,
does well in general.
Yeah.
The one major complaint to get, mm-hmm, to this, we couldn't quite understand about counterplay, resist, and,
yeah,
crossplay.
That was really difficult.
That was our one flaw.
I was having a lot of trouble understanding it, and I think it had a lot to do with more with how the manual itself was formatted.
Yeah.
I kept searching for things that weren't there, it didn't seem. It seems like an editorial problem in part to me.
Possibly, yeah.
I also think that maybe there's just too many different types of roles going on, different types of possible roles for combat, because you have resist, you have counters, you have cross plays, and you
have interference,
and you have all of these different possibilities.
There are only actually like five, I think.
Yeah,
it seemed like a lot to me.
But there's a lot of situations that can seem like one, but maybe
like
another
one,
because
that,
of the very specific.
Yeah, how would call it, which one? I mean, shit like interference and that stuff is easy.
Right.
But like calling, deciding whether you resist, especially with an NPC you haven't built beforehand.
Right.
And that was kind of something that I didn't really know if you were supposed to build NPCs beforehand.
He talks about that a little bit. Basically,
you give them backgrounds.
Major NPCs, yes.
Right. But how do you tell what's a major NPC?
Well, often major NPCs show up in play.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. And I guess if someone showed up in one, since this is supposed to be a multi-session arc, for the most part, it's not really supposed to be one self-contained
session
as we
true.
Played it. If someone starts to seem like they're becoming a major NPC,
you
could sit down and build a sheet between sessions, I think.
Because it seemed to me like in ours, the Arab dad should have been a major
NPC. He should have had a sheet and should have been a major NPC. But when we were building it in the beginning, it was hard to tell how much of a role he was going to have.
Because
he might only have had one scene.
Yeah, exactly.
And just getting back to what you were talking about with cross plays and counters and stuff, you write that it's not many options, but it's five options all within a very small conceptual space.
Yeah, yeah.
Meaning that they're all, that you've got five options that are all doing things that on the surface seem very similar. And that's something that's kind of hard to parse. And I think that's the problem I was having, was parsing all of that. And the explanations of how, when you roll, who is rolling, when you have people rolling at the same time, that could have been more clearly laid out in the text.
True, yeah.
He goes back to it a few times, but each time he goes back to it, it almost seems to say a different thing. And I don't think it does, but it's just the way it's worded. It's kind of difficult.
I think maybe there should have been more examples of, like, basic play structure, like how you do roles.
Yeah.
Like an example where you have, like, people saying stuff in character and then people saying stuff out of character.
Yes.
Like
Dick
says, I want to roll for this. Okay, Dick, how do you do that? Or whatever, that kind of stuff.
I think that would have helped.
That would have probably helped the flow of play a little bit.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So, yeah, we have about 10 minutes left.
Yeah.
Yep.
I can't think of anything else.
Yeah.
If I had to say one big thing, if I had to offer Stephoid one big takeaway, and I guess you guys can do this too after I'm done, I would say frame this game. Add a page to the beginning that tells us what we want to get out of this game. Is this a game fundamentally about introducing new people to story games? Is this a
an attempt to create a kind of generic, universal, narrativist gaming system? Or is this a game about playing your favorite movie? Or is it all three? And if it's all three, okay, but frame it for me in the first page, because it took me a while reading the manual, to really figure out that those were what was going on.
Right.
Yeah, I would have, the one thing that I would have to say is, this is just personal though, maybe, the manual didn't seem like it flowed well from section to section to me. Some proofreading would be necessary is all I gotta say on that.
Get an editor if you can.
Yeah, definitely. Because that's very hard to read.
I volunteer my services.
Yeah, that's... You definitely got something there, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd say more examples, especially of how play actually is supposed to work.
Not just more examples. Clear examples.
Yeah. I thought most of the examples he had there were pretty...
Most were, but there were, like, what was it with the motivations? The, The influences.
The influences,
That didn't seem clear enough.
Yeah. And in fact, the whole motivation section could have had clearer examples.
That's
right. Examples that were more like the examples later when you got into the actual play examples and the other character creation examples. Just each, if you want to keep all five motivations, then have one really fleshed out sentence long example for each one.
Yep.
You could even do it sort of in a chart style.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely. Oh, that's something we didn't talk about is the scene framing chart, which I think worked pretty well.
Yes, that's right.
I like that. Now, I'm a sucker for rolling a D percentile and picking something out of the chart.
I actually love that chart. It was pretty good.
Yeah.
I think we all are on that.
Yeah.
Yes.
I like the fact that it was suggestive without being too suggestive.
Yeah, he can put a lot of thought into into those, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, that was definitely cool. I think any final thoughts on Engine Era?
One thing I'd say is, mechanically, it looks really solid, but just show how the mechanics work in the text a lot more.
Yes.
And give examples of how, of the people actually talking about the mechanics.
Yes.
Like, you know, okay, I'm going to roll now, what do I do? That kind of thing. Because I felt like I was kind of hindered from doing things because I didn't want to screw up the mechanical or make it a burden. So
right.
That's the only thing I'd say.
Yeah, and that's true, because we did get derailed on mechanics for about half an hour.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be mostly a big misunderstanding, but we had to start through the rules to figure out where the misunderstanding was.
Right.
And that could have been... I don't think... It didn't seem to hinder play too much.
No.
Because ultimately it's a series of simple rules, but...
Right. Yeah,
but yeah, I can definitely see where you're coming from, absolutely. Any other final thoughts? Next week, do you want to do Final Hour of a Storied Age, or do you want to do Demi-Lich?
I think we should tackle Final Hour of a Storied Age.
Okay. So expect that next week. We're going to we'll do a private playtest of Final Hour of a Storied Age, and then on podcast, on episode 26, we will talk about it, and we'll probably have some bullshit topical stuff at the beginning.
Yep.
Okay, so that was episode 25 of Mom's Basement Podcast.
Mom's Basement.
And, signing off.
Callan, I still want you to have my baby.
Yeah, you should really talk to Rudy about this. Send him a PM or something. Yeah. Maybe you can set up a time. You can meet at a sperm bank or something, and you can get this thing taken care of. Even though you were both biologically male, I mean, we're living in the modern age here.
We can figure it out.
All right.